Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I am Gary Gramling, here, as always, with Andy Benoit. And this week, we have our defensive lineman show. We are going to count down the top defensive linemen in the NFL. And Andy, you will never believe who number one is.
Well, I would have a little bit of an assumption. What we probably need to establish for our listeners, because we had to establish it for ourselves, what we're describing as defensive linemen, because some of these edge players, which we're not doing in this show, they complicate it so much. I have a guy
Correct.
Who's charting plays for me now, and we're having a big headache with what to do with these outside linebacker D-end guys.
I think Michael Bennett was the only guy we really had a conversation on.
Yeah, because we're going to do the edge guys in a week or two, so this was the everybody else guys, and that included any defensive tackles, certainly. Nose tackles, of course, and then we came up with 3-4 defensive ends, and that's even hard to do because so many 3-4 teams play one gap principles out of a 3-4, and so the defensive ends often the same thing as he would have been in a 4-3. But what we're saying, like with J.J. Watt, for example, and spoiler alert, he's going to be our number one on this list. We went with him as a D lineman because he plays the strong side so often that he's often in the trenches. He's got bodies on both sides of his shoulders when he lines up more often than not. So that's kind of the criteria. And yeah, Michael Bennett was the toughest one. I think of him as a three technique, though, because Seattle plays nickel like any team. They play nickel most of the time.
Yep. Well, Michael Bennett will be included in this week's show. He did make the top 15. I don't think that's too much of a surprise. We're doing something a little bit differently this week. Usually this is the part of the show where I say we're going to take a trip around the NFL, latest news and headlines. We're not going to do that this week. We're going to fold in some latest news and headlines into the countdown because there just weren't many headlines over the past week since we last talked. And
the headlines apply to a lot of defensive linemen anyway.
Exactly. I was just going to say that, Andy.
Stop being so impatient. That was rude of me. That was rude.
You know, once the show is over, drop us a line. Tell us whether you love the format or hate the new format. And if you say anything in between, we will ignore you. Because it has to be one or the other. All right, let's jump into it. If you are just tuning in for the first time, this is part of our off-season position rankings. And the way we do it, it's AP poll style. Myself, Andy, and Jeff Irwin, our researcher, each rank our top 15 at each position. First place vote gets 15 points. Second place gets 14 points, all the way down to a 15th place vote gets 1 point. Andy Benoit's vote counts double, because he knows that much about football. The others receiving vote this week, we had Dantari Poe with 5 points, Cameron Hayward with 5 points, Brandon Williams with 4, Mike Daniels with 4, and Damon Harrison with 1. Andy, I know you're a big Dantari Poe guy, and I believe you are also the one who included Brandon Williams in his list. Do you take exception to either of those guys being excluded?
Not really, because this is maybe the deepest position that we've done so far. And I was going to make the hedging statement at the beginning of this that guys 2 through 7, 2 through 8, to me, you could put them in any order. So we're going to talk different football concepts rather than just this guy's better than that guy, because it's the grayest position we have. And Brandon Williams, I put him on my list. I don't think I did put Poe on the list, but both guys move exceptionally well for nose tackle type players, especially for their round body types. Great feet. And we're going to find that's the case with a lot of these defensive linemen.
Well, let's jump into the guys who did make the top 15, and we're going to start with Derek Wolfe, Denver Broncos. He actually did not make your list or my list.
But we got the Jeff Irwin factor again.
The Irwin factor, where is he? He's 10th on Irwin's list.
Yeah.
And I had Wolfe 21 or so on my list. I don't think it's ridiculous to put him in the top 15. I didn't put him there because I think he benefits greatly from the guys playing the edge in Denver. I think he's a good player in his own right, but I don't think he is a guy who would, if he was the focal point of a defensive line and an opponent were worrying about him and primarily him, I don't think you'd see the kind of production that he gives the Broncos.
No, one thing he does do on the positive, I think he's a very good player, and you're right, he does belong in the discussion. 15 top 15 is high for my taste. But when we saw this in the Super Bowl, he gives them a run defending presence out of sub packages if they want to go that way. They can play the run and still have three cornerbacks on the field. And when I say play the run, I mean have everyone in the position they want, have guys at the point of attack, have the right number of body counts, which gets into some of their advantages with the secondary. But they can play multiple types of different gap schemes in run defense out of sub packages. Mm-hmm. And Malik Jackson was tremendous for them in this regard in the Super Bowl. And Wolf has always been very good at that.
Well, speaking of Malik Jackson, who came up a little bit earlier in this conversation, look at who's number 14, Malik Jackson. Leaves Denver, signs the six-year deal, $42 million guaranteed with the Jacksonville Jaguars, part of their spending spree. I kind of mentioned with Wolf how he's sort of a product of the talent surrounding him. Do you think Jackson falls under that same category?
No, I don't, because Jackson, did he see more one-on-one blocking last season? Yeah, sure, mm-hmm. But you can get that with anyone around you. You don't have to have DeMarcus Ware or Von Miller outside of you, especially if you're able to go inside or outside where you line up the way Jackson is. He has very, very good lateral movement skills in confined areas, very similar to Michael Bennett in that regard. Bennett's the best in the league at that, moving left and right very quickly off the snap of the ball. Mm-hmm. And that you're going to be difficult to block anytime you have that mixed with an ability to fire off quickly and go forward. So we're talking east, west, north, south movement skills for a guy. There's another guy with light feet as well. And whether he's double teamed or single teamed, he'll be more effective when he's single teamed. But I didn't watch on film last season and get the sense that Malik Jackson was like a product of the system. In fact, you could argue he made DeMarcus Ware good, not the other way around, because Malik Jackson is so good on stunts and setting up other guys on stunts as well, where he takes the blocker on and the other defensive end loops around behind him.
Yep.
Jackson's exceptional in that. And Jacksonville, by the way, they do a lot of that in their pass rush. I'm sure that was not lost on them when they paid him all that money.
So that's a nice fit for the Jags here.
I think it's a great fit. Any guy with Malik Jackson's skill set, though, will be a good fit. Malik Jackson also played two gaps at times in Denver's base packages. And as good as he is, we think of him as a pass rusher because the stuff we're describing here is mostly pass rush elements. But his best snaps in the Super Bowl were against the run. He was absolutely dominant at holding ground at the point of attack, which was critical against a team like Carolina, because Carolina moves its blockers so much on gap scheme runs, pull blockers, guys that loop around and get out in front. Jackson was outstanding there. So I think he'll fit in Jacksonville wherever they play him. I'd play him at strong side defensive end, and then I'd move him to three technique in sub packages if I go to nickel.
All right. And you were actually a lone wolf on Jackson here. You had him 12th.
You guys didn't rank Jackson?
Irwin didn't have him. I had him 19.
Okay, that surprises me. I thought, especially because he got paid, so guys tend to get overrated right after they get paid.
Andy, maybe you got
maybe,
drawn
maybe
into
I
that.
Overrated
maybe
we'll
you
see.
Were the one who got fooled.
We'll see. One of the other reasons that guys look overrated after they get paid is because some guys change after they get paid. And so we have to wait and see how Malik Jackson performs. I'm not going to predict one way or the other.
Yeah.
But he's in a very different spot in his life now than he was at this time a year ago, especially when he has a Super Bowl ring on top of it all.
Yeah. Coming in 13, we have Linval Joseph. Now, it was tough for me to separate between Joseph and Floyd. I think they play off each other so well. I ended up putting Joseph 14. Irwin had him 9. You didn't rank him, but you had him in that group of sort of guys you considered here, it looks like. Would you agree with Joseph over Floyd if you had to take one for your defensive line right now for your imaginary team?
Yeah, that's tough because, for one, if you'd told me Linval Joseph would make the list at number 13, I would have thought it would have been on the strength of my vote because I think Linval Joseph is outstanding. I think he's the last year and a half, 2 years, and certainly last season, he's the best run-stopping defensive lineman, interior defensive lineman, D-tackle, in the NFL. The best. He is phenomenal. Now, the issue with him is he's a nose shade tackle. So he's not a gap shooter. And what that means is he plays first and second down, but he's not going to be on the field in most third down situations. And that's what makes it hard, because Joseph's a more impactful player than Floyd when Joseph's on the field, but Floyd's on the field more than Joseph. And so whose impact is greater in the aggregate? I struggle with that one. I think a lot of teams do as well when trying to assign a value to a player. And that's why guys like Linval Joseph don't get into the Pro Bowl when they probably deserve to be Pro Bowlers.
Yeah. You know, I saw him a lot when he was with the Giants here, and I thought he always really covered up for their lack of talent in the linebacking core. And I think you saw a difference once he left New York and headed out to Minnesota. I think you sort of saw those linebackers for the Giants exposed. And that's something that the Giants never invest in, and that's just the way they run things there. But I think they have missed what Linval Joseph used to give them.
And keep in mind, Minnesota's got linebackers that need to have some of the help, like Kendricks, for example. Eric Kendricks, their linebacker, is someone who needs to be kept clean. He's got that body type. He's a runner. He's not a stack and shed guy necessarily when he's taking on blocks. And so Linval Joseph is very valuable to someone like that. I thought he got Joseph. Got better after leaving the Giants and going to the Vikings too.
Yeah.
Did you see it that way?
Yeah, but I think the Vikings sort of coach all those guys up. Mike Zimmer's got a good program there.
He does. He's got a very specific scheme, and he knows exactly how to teach the scheme and which guys he needs to run it. And that gets into the continuity of the NFL, is when you know what your scheme is from year to year, and when you keep the same coaching staff in place, it becomes easier to draft and accumulate or sign the right kind of players, because you're that much more intimately familiar with your scheme. And the more you sign the right kind of players, the easier it becomes to get the right kind of players, because now we're talking about guys filling very specific roles and niches, and guys who can do this, don't need them to do that, but we know they can do this, and that's what they do well, and that's what we want. All that becomes easier with continuity, and the Vikings are starting to ease into that now, because they've been there a few years. Zimmer has had the same scheme over the years, so he was able to accelerate the process, and he knew right away which types of players he wants. And one of those types of players is a classic nose shade tackle like Joseph is.
Yep. So Linval Joseph, 13th, coming in 12th, Calais Campbell, who is really an absolute rock out in Arizona. And it's funny, because when I was putting together my rankings, I was thinking, how high can I go with Campbell? Because it seems like he's always banged up. He plays at least 14 games every year. I'm looking at it now. You know, when he had the major injury in, I think it was the Denver game 2 years ago, he ended up still playing 14 games, made 14 starts, still an impact in the pass rush, still, you know, one of the best when it comes to stopping the run. We all had him on our list. I had him 15. You and Irwin both had him 13.
I bet you he leads the all-time NFL list for number of Pro Bowls missed by one spot. Like, he's always been the guy who just missed the Pro Bowl. He was the fifth best when they picked four or something like that. Watching him on film, he flashes and stands out as much as any defensive lineman in the league. Now, part of that's because he's so big, and a guy that can move as well as he does and have such arm length and height. He's 6'8", and his arms are the length of a guy who's probably 7 foot, I'm guessing. That kind of guy is going to flash on film, but what he does with that body, we talked about Malik Jackson's ability to go left and right in confined areas. Campbell's lateral movement covers a lot of ground. It's a different type of lateral mobility, but he still has it, and he can work down the line of scrimmage extremely well. So he's tough to corral like that, because he moves left and right so well. He doesn't get through small cracks, but he can destroy the interior of an offensive line just by lining up and sliding to his left or to his right. He's great range in that regard. Is he not 30? I thought he's been old for a while. That's, you know why? It's because, like you said, he's not injury prone, but he's on the injury list a lot. He plays hurt a lot. That probably just makes a guy seem older than he is. He came in the league in 2008. He's been around a little bit, but he'll be 30 on opening day this year.
Yeah. You know, that was the Denver game. That was I couldn't remember off the top of my head. It was the Julius Thomas chop block, and it looked like it was going to end Campbell's season, because it was such an ugly play. And all of a sudden, you know, the guy's back 2 weeks later.
I remember that now. That was the game Denver destroyed Arizona through the air, wasn't it? Didn't Denver have like 500 yards passing or something like that? A lot of long touchdowns.
Yeah. Yeah.
And after that game, Arizona changed their coverage approach because what Denver did was they moved their wide receivers around a lot, left side of the formation, right side, et cetera. And that made the running, that made the cornerbacks have to run across the field before the snap a lot. And that wore those guys out. So after that, Arizona tweaked their approach for a little while to keep their corners on the same side of the field because they were getting exhausted traveling with wide receivers. The little things you have to think about, that's the kind of stuff coaches think about when they come up with a scheme. And then people like you and me, Gary, we sit in the room and criticize them, say, oh, why did they play man coverage? How can you play man coverage against Odell Beckham? Or why wouldn't you press Beckham? How can you just play zone again? Or whatever it is. And there's a lot of other factors that go in between it. And sometimes it's as simple as they see their guys get tired.
You know what, Andy? We are an important part of the ecosystem.
They're kind of in the way like dirt is important to certain organisms that get eaten by the smallest fish.
There you go. There you go. I'll take that. Calais Campbell is 12th. 11th, we have Marcel Darius, Buffalo Bills. Who, whenever I think of Marcel Darius, I still think of that draft. And that was the draft that Andrew Luck opted out of. So Bills fans still talk about
draft, then.
Yeah, and we still talk about Russ Brandon when we went to dinner with him a couple of years ago. The Bills president said, you know, if Andrew Luck comes out that year, Cam Newton gets pushed down to 3. I mean, the worst case scenario for them is Newton gets pushed down to 2 and then they take Von Miller. But they got Marcel Darius instead, who's a good player.
Yeah, it took him a little while to become what we knew he could become. And there's still a hint of inconsistency with him. If we're comparing him to the rest of the guys on this list, his peers.
Mm-hmm.
But all the traits we've talked about so far, nose shade, lateral movement and confined space, working down the line of scrimmage, quick off the snap, Darius is capable of all of those, and you see it 5 or 6 times a game. I think the Bills, and they've paid him, so they're happy with him, but I bet you they would tell you they'd like to see it 20 or 30 times a game.
Yeah.
He's really, and I'm not saying he's that inconsistent, but you know what I'm getting at. He has the potential to be an every down force. And when he's good, he is a really good level of good.
So Rob Ryan coming in there as the new defensive assistant head coach or whatever his title is going to be. Do you think he does anything different with Darius than they've done in the past? And I guess the past being last year, since that was Rex's only year in Buffalo so far.
Not necessarily. I don't know if we'll see anything radically different. Not for Darius so much, because what we're hearing about the Bills is they're going to attach themselves closer to Rex Ryan's scheme, probably simplify it a little bit or streamline it. But that will be more for their blitz packages. And Darius will be a little bit a part of that. But that's really, it's more at the edge guys and linebackers. What you need to know about the Bills scheme and how it pertains to Marcel Darius, the Ryans don't coach gap sound technique. They don't say, you got this gap, you got that gap, you're responsible for these gaps. They tell their defensive linemen, just kick the tail out of the guy in front of you. And if you penetrate, if you get past the offensive lineman, you're going to make everybody right. You can never be wrong when you penetrate.
Yeah.
It's your job to beat the lineman. It's the linebacker's job to read it and clean up from there. So don't worry about gaps so much. And that can be empowering for a guy who's really talented. That's one reason the Jets have always, before they do it still, but even in the past years, they go after defensive linemen early in the draft. Because if you're going to play that way, you want a really talented defensive lineman, a guy who can consistently kick the tail of the guy lining up across from him. And that's where Darius fits the mold. And I would like to see him become that guy for them. Their Muhammad Wilkerson type impact guy.
Yep.
He'd be doing it more from the inside than Wilkerson.
Well, Darius coming in 11th on your poll. He was 12th on mine. He was 14th on Jeff's. Marcel Darius 11 and Jarrell Casey. Tennessee Titans getting a little respect here in our countdown. Maybe for the first time? Have we any Titans on the list yet?
I don't think we have. Yeah, but that's not a good sign for them, is it? People think Tennessee's roster is like embarrassing. I've never thought. I don't look at it and say, oh, they can't compete with these guys. But you're right. We haven't had them on a top 15 list yet.
Oh, so, you know what? We did. We had Delanie Walker in the tight ends.
Okay. All right. Well,
so here's so number 2, Jarrell Casey.
Jarrell Casey, I'm really glad he made this list because he probably deserves to be higher. The way they use him, he does more for his team stylistically than any defensive lineman in the league. He lines up in more places, has more techniques that he's a part of. He's part of their stunts and twists, some of their zone blitz concepts. He can line up at defensive tackle or defensive end. And the best part is he really doesn't look like a guy that would play that way. He's kind of built like a medicine ball. He looks like a medicine ball out there, but he plays with the athleticism of a gymnast.
Yes.
I think Jarrell, and the more he plays, the better he seems to get. So I like Jarrell Casey. What's his contract deal? Has he been paid? It looks like he signed an extension in 2014. 5 years, $37 million in 2014, guaranteed 20.5.
Yeah, so he got the four-year deal. He is under contract until 2018, $20.5 million guaranteed. So he's doing all right.
He's doing all right. Yeah,
should be better, though.
Tennessee got a good deal on this, though.
Yeah.
They signed him at just the right time. Look what defensive linemen are costing nowadays. And Ndamukong Suh cost, what was he, 50? He was 50-plus guaranteed.
Yeah.
And Ndamukong Suh hasn't even been as good as Jarrell Casey the last several years.
Yeah? You think so?
Yeah, no, Casey has been more valuable to the Titans than Suh has been to the Dolphins, comparatively.
Interesting.
I'm Casey, I would hold out. I really would.
Oh, you can't hold out with that many years left on the deal, though.
You don't think so?
Too far away.
16, 17, 18.
Yeah, 3 years
when
left
on it. What do you think he... All right, next year, he's making $5.4 million this year plus $600,000 in different bonuses.
Yeah.
So can he hold out next season?
Yeah. I give him the green light. I give him permission to hold out if he wants to next season.
If he can take the fines, it's harder to do with the new fines they've set up.
Yeah.
The point is, he is over-delivered. And Tennessee was wise to sign him when they did, and maybe Casey wanted the security up front. But football people, I think, would tell you he's worth $40 million guaranteed in today's money, based on the new money available from the TV deals now.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned the body type, because we talk about guys passing the eye test, especially when it comes up to the draft. And I remember when he was coming out of USC, everyone sort of looked at his production and his tape, and then they saw his body, and it's like, it's a little bit non-traditional, a little bit roly-poly, a little bit Mike Tolbert-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's why he probably dropped out of the first round. But, man, he can play.
Who do you think are some of the best bad body guys of all time, football or even other sports? I had this conversation the other day with basketball. It was kind of similar. I was talking with my buddy about basketball players and who's the all, like, no-hops team, like, all the guys that can't get off the floor. If you could put the best at each position, what kind of team would you have? And that to me, like, that's the football equivalent. Like, bad body guys are guys that wouldn't jump very high if they were basketball players. It doesn't mean they can't play. It just means they're Zach Randolph.
Well, it's funny. Like, Charles Barkley, who might be a little old for you. Obviously, you know who he is. But when he was playing, and you see his body now during his prime compared to what he weighs these days, you kind of say, wow, he was round mound of rebound. That doesn't really add up. But he was, you know, he was a pudgy, sort of wide-bodied dude.
Could he get off the ground, though? I thought he had a little bit of explosiveness in the Philadelphia and Phoenix years.
Oh, he was also, he had that, like, jumping jack style. He wasn't like an Oliver Miller guy. I don't know if you remember Oliver Miller, who was just...
I do, yeah.
He's obscenely large on the court. But
I do remember Oliver Miller. I was an unfortunate-looking man.
The late Robert Traylor's another guy. Didn't really work out, sort of had that Barkley-ish body type or what it would have been for the modern era. But yeah, the only other guy in baseball I always think, it's not an athleticism thing, but Jose Altuve, who's the, you know, 5'5" Astros second baseman, who, you know, dude's going to hit 15, 20 home runs a year, which it doesn't add up when you look at his body.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's the size of, you know, some of these little league pitchers that you see. But yeah, Jarrell Casey. So he comes in at 10th on our ranking of the top 15 defensive linemen in football. We are going to take a quick 30-second break, and we will come back, have a couple of mailbag questions, and we'll also roll out the top 9 on our countdown. The Cleveland Cavaliers are NBA champions, and LeBron James has fulfilled his vow to Northeast Ohio. It's been an emotional roller coaster for Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver, but they have just enough left for one more playoff episode of the Open Floor podcast. Find it on si.com/podcasts or search for Open Floor on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. So, Andy, we're going to take a quick break from the countdown and reach into the mailbag, see what we've got here. As always, if you want to reach out to me and Andy, we are on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or ggramling_si, or you can send an email to talkback@themqb.com. If you put podcast in the subject line, it has a much better chance of actually being seen by human eyes. This first one here is directed to you, Andy. I'm excluded, and that's okay, VJ. This is coming from VJ. Andy, if you can explain, I would like to know the difference between run blocking and pass blocking when talking about offensive linemen. I never understand when analysts say player X is a good run blocker, but not a good pass blocker.
Yeah, on the surface, that question seems elementary, but that's a really good question because it's some of those basic ones that get you thinking about football the right way. And the thing you have to remember most is when you're pass blocking, you're totally reactionary. So your athleticism is a different demand on it. You probably need to be a better athlete, in fact, just like cornerbacks are better athletes than everyone else on the field. Corners play the most reactionary position in football. Second most would be pass blockers. You're reacting to the attacker in front of you. Run blocking, and the reason offensive linemen like it more is you're now the aggressor.
Yeah.
You're going after them. And so that's the very basic one. As far as what kind of skills go where, it almost matters where you line up. The difference between a guard and a tackle and pass blocking and even run blocking as well can be pretty significant for a variety of reasons. Most of it has to do with space and the kind of help that you have around you from other blockers. And we could get into schemes and all that, which maybe we save that for the offensive line show, but it never hurts to just remind yourself whenever thinking about football, okay, pass blocking, what's it like? They're being reactionary. They have to be. What's that like? Run blocking, they're the aggressor. What's mm-hmm. that like? And then evaluate the guy from there.
Well, there you go, VJ. That's why he asked you, because you had a much better answer than I would have had.
Well, and then VJ's going to have to listen to the next show or whenever we get to offensive linemen as well.
There you go. So we're going to continue on with the countdown of the top defensive linemen in football. Coming in ninth here is Gerald McCoy. And Jeff Irwin, our researcher, he's a good dude. We give him some flack here. And as I always say, he is not here to defend himself. He does every once in a while send in his defenses for some of these rankings that he does. This one is the one he made a preemptive strike on. He omitted Gerald McCoy from his list, and he offered the reason that while still an elite pass rusher, his run defense last season was poor. Among all interior defenders who played at least 50 snaps, McCoy ranked 139th in Pro Football Focus's game charting grades. So I don't have a huge issue with Gerald McCoy not being on the list here, or Derek Wolfe being on the list, which was a Irwin only lone wolf vote. I guess my point on McCoy, and I had him 6, and you had him at 9. That pass rush threat, I mean, it's far more important than anything else that happens on the defensive line now. And he's an elite pass rusher, and that's enough to make him among the best defensive linemen in the game.
I agree with you. We know Irwin's going to throw a bomb on this once a show. He's just been doing that, whether it was Dez Bryant being off his list or Jason Witten off his list or whatever. He's done what Adrian Peterson was number 10 on his running backs. He does that every show. Now, this is this week's bomb from Irwin, and it's not that bad. It's we can live. We can survive this bomb.
Yeah.
We're crawling out of the wreckage on this one. I had McCoy. Where did I have him? I had him 9, so mm-hmm. I had him where he falls on the list. He wasn't himself last year. There's no question about that. He played with a shoulder injury, so he didn't practice for the second half of the season. The Buccaneers felt that was a big factor. You got to look at the whole body of work, though. And as an initial get-off guy, as just getting from point A in the on the defensive line to point B in the backfield, he gets from A to B as explosively as anyone in the league. Now, he's not a lateral mover like we've talked about with some of the other guys. Mm-hmm. The run defense thing, I question that a little bit just because McCoy's the best defensive lineman on a one-gap penetrating team, and that Buccaneer run defense last year ranked second in the league in yards per attempt. So I find it hard to understand how McCoy could be, and I get it, it's different players and team, but the best D-lineman on that line could not be ranked in the 140s or wherever he was, and that run defense still gives up only 3.4 yards an attempt.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm with you. I have the guy
stats
six.
Stats with stats, by the way. How do you like that? Stats with stats. Fight.
There you go. It's like a good band name right there. Gerald McCoy comes in at 9. Coming in at 8, Kawan Short. He was a top 10 for all of us, top 8 for all of us. You and I had him 8th where he is, and Irwin had him at 5. And another guy they need to talk about freeing up some money to keep around there in Carolina.
And that's an interesting one, too. That's a really interesting situation now. What they had with Norman was a case of a guy worth more than they were willing to pay his position. They don't pay cornerbacks in Carolina because they've invested other positions and their scheme doesn't demand great cornerbacking. And so Norman was not worth $1 million a game. So they let him go. Kawan Short is going to be worth $1 million a game or whatever the Fletcher Cox line is now. We'll get to Fletcher Cox shortly, it looks like. But Dave Gettleman, their GM, has basically said publicly, it's not for me. I'm not into overbidding for guys. They drafted a defensive tackle, Vernon Butler, in the first round this year. They've got Starlo Tulele for one more year on his rookie deal. I think they're gonna have a bullet to bite on this one, Gary. I don't think you can get away with letting Kawan Short get away because their models are set up to pay defensive linemen. Yeah. And this is what good defensive linemen cost now.
Were you surprised they paid Michael Ower? And they didn't pay Michael Ower. They didn't give Michael Ower a monster contract. But he got $9.5 million guaranteed. He got a 3-year deal here. I was surprised by that.
That seems about right to me for Michael Ower. I think Ower is a slightly below average NFL left tackle, but in that kind of scheme where they have so many fullbacks or tight ends or extra running backs on the field, plus Cam Newton with the misdirection stuff they do with him, oftentimes the guy lining up across from Ower is not the one Ower has to block because Cam Newton does the read option stuff. So I think if you can get a left tackle at $9.5 million guaranteed, that's a pretty good deal for any kind of left tackle. And I like that they didn't overpay Ower because a lot of teams would say, hey, we made the Super Bowl. We better get our left tackle paid because that's what the position demands. And that's another position that Carolina doesn't need great players at in order to survive.
Yeah, I guess that's...
What would you have thought Orr's contract would be?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if I'd even bother re-signing the guy. He's a replacement-level guy.
Then the question becomes, who do you replace
exactly? I don't know what the solution would be. I don't know what the next step would be. But I don't know. Was anyone else coming after him?
That's the one I kind of wonder, too, is why did he get the money now? That's a good question. That's worth asking. We're not going to find the answer to that. No. They won't tell us. The Panthers wouldn't say that. It wouldn't be good for them to say that. But, yeah, that is a little weird because there can't be that great of demand for Michael Ower. I don't mean to rip on the guy, but run block or pass block, he's not an impressive specimen.
Yeah.
He's not awful. He's just not. He's not a difference maker. You're right.
Yeah. No, look, that's not a deal that's going to make or break them one way or the other, you would think at least. But yeah, I don't know. I'm surprised they were so proactive and so seemingly aggressive in getting him re-signed, whereas they're really taking a hard line with, and again, it's a lot more money, but they're really taking a hard line with Norman and now with Kawan Short. Apparently talks have stalled and no indication they are picking back up anytime soon.
And they don't need to pick up immediately because they have next year to deal with and they can franchise tag him if they want. I think just to take the bigger picture, though, they could afford to not pay Norman based on the way they're set up there in Carolina to play. They cannot afford to not pay Short. They need to keep him around.
Yeah.
It's a different situation.
Yeah. You wrote about this a little bit earlier in the year, I think, if I remember correctly. Assuming you had to allocate all that money to Short, would you be comfortable letting Lotulelei walk?
I would need to see exactly what type of player Vernon Butler is first.
Yeah.
It's tough. Lotulelei is, he's a little bit of a first and second down guy as well, though he can pop in on third down and make a difference. He's not a true nose shade. I don't know, because Lotulelei is the exact type of guy that's going to get offered big money somewhere. Someone else would sign him. So they might have to let him walk because he could be, in theory, they could be perceived as more valuable to a team that's never had a guy like him than to a team like Carolina that has guys like him every year. And if I have to choose between Lotulelei and Short, which they probably ultimately will, I'm choosing Kawan Short.
Yeah, pick Short. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that Vernon Butler pick looms. That was another classic Dave Gettleman draft day move. You know, take the long view.
What kind, Gary, did you watch him at Louisiana Tech at all? Is he, what kind of tackles? He's 6'4", 323. So I'm guessing he's not an upfield tackle. Is he a gap plugger type?
Yeah, he's more of a Lotulelei type than he is a Kawan Short type. You know, you would think that if you're grooming him for either one of those spots on the defensive line, he's going to be the heir apparent for Lotulelei. He moves well for 323. I mean, if you watched him, and granted, it's always tough. Louisiana Tech is a second-tier program, and that's not a knock. They don't play in the SEC or the Big Ten or the Big 12 or Pac-12. But, you know, when you see Butler out there, he moves like a guy who is, you know, about 20 pounds lighter than 323.
Well, and your point about the competition's a good one, because in college, the worst athletes are almost always the interior offensive linemen.
Yeah.
Because there's still, it's amateur football at the end of the day. And so there's still a little bit of, you're a big guy, we're going to let you play football. Where do we put you? And often it becomes where we're going to put you at guard or whatever.
Yeah.
But the worst athletes on the field are guards and centers in college, especially guards. And that's who defensive tackles go against. It's one reason D tackles, and it used to be true more often than it is now for whatever reason, but D tackles have a little bit of a tougher transition to the NFL at times. And sometimes Gerald McCoy is a good example, though he was hurt. It still took him 2 or 3 years to figure out how to play at the pro level.
Yep.
And Kawan Short is a little bit like that too. Short did not explode out of the gates. Kawan Short got great this past year.
Yep. Well, Kawan Short comes in eighth in our countdown of the top defensive linemen in football. Coming in seven, Michael Bennett, the guy who we didn't know whether to put him at edge or put him on this list. We put him on this list. Andy wanted him on this list. I just wanted to discuss it, but Andy said he belongs here because he's a three technique.
He is, and I'd already made my list at that point. I was on my phone, and it would have been hard to adjust the list because I would have had to click very precisely in the list to change the numbers. So
there
you
go.
He's a three technique, though. He plays more three technique than he does defensive end.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you look at, what is he, about 270?
For weight, he is. Yeah, that's probably about his build.
And that's why you still look at him and say, oh, that guy, he's an edge guy. 270, that's an edge guy. That's an edge guy's weight. That's an edge guy's body. I don't know. As far as interior pass rush, where do you put Bennett? I mean, what, Aaron Donald, Gerald McCoy?
I put Bennett ahead of McCoy.
Yeah?
I do now. I would not have 2 or 3 years ago, but I do now.
I don't know if we necessarily have Watt on the list of pure interior guys, but...
Yeah, it would be between, and the guys we're going to talk about, Geno Atkins, Donald, and Bennett. To me, it's between, and maybe Kawan Short. I think those are top four pure interior pass rushers, just pure upfield guys. What makes Bennett so unique is, like we've talked about, the lateral agility. His is off the charts.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't have to beat you with his first step, which is another reason I don't think of him as a pure edge guy. He often does win with his first step. His first step's also borderline off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
But where you go, wow, watching him, is with the quickness of his hands and his ability to redirect on his second step off the snap. And that's a skill set that suits a defensive lineman inside really well. It's good at any position. Bennett's dominant. He would be a top 15 edge rusher as well in our list. He's dominant. I'll tell you what, Gary, the conversation we're having now, we're going to hear a lot more about this because at some point, Michael Bennett's going to want either a new contract or he'll be due for one. He's in the third year of a 4-year deal, and it's a deal that doesn't pay him a whole lot of money. relatively speaking, to some of the contracts we've seen. He got 4 years, $28.5 million. He signed that back in 2014, just like Jarrell Casey. So Bennett's going to want paid like a defensive end, and Seattle's going to say you're a defensive tackle, and we'll see how that goes. And that's for down the road. But I bet you Michael Bennett's had the conversation we've had more than once with his agents already.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
One other thing about Bennett real fast. Mm-hmm. People think he broke out in Seattle. He stood out on film like this when he was with the Buccaneers as well. Yeah. And he played more defensive end for them. But at the time, I remember thinking it was a major blunder to let Michael Bennett get away for Tampa Bay there.
If you ever get a chance, and someone put this out as a blind item on Twitter last year, I can't remember who it was, but Michael Bennett's pre-draft workout numbers were atrocious. And you look at him on the field now and say, wow, how did this guy go undrafted? And he was he was at A&M, he was a little bit up and down there. But, you know, he was a 5-flat 40-second guy at 260 pounds or whatever it was. I mean, he had the combine measurables of an undraftable player. So it kind of made sense. Seahawks signed him and then waived him, and then the Bucks picked him up, and then he ended up back in Seattle. But
and that's how he came into the league. He was signed as a college free agent then.
Yeah. The Seahawks signed him as a college free agent and waived him, I think, before the first season, or maybe very early in that first season.
Yeah, they waived really early in that. Well, he was on the roster to begin the season, but he joined Tampa Bay midway through 2009, I see. Those combine drills that you talk about, they don't measure skill sets combined together. They measure skill sets in a vacuum. So they've got drills to measure lateral explosiveness and short area burst, but they don't measure it when you factor in the hand quickness as well. And so Bennett's a different combination of beast because he's quick in the hands and in the feet in unique ways. It speaks to the limitations of drills. I get why they do the drills. We've talked about them.
Yep.
But you got to watch the film with guys. Michael Bennett's always going to be better on film than he is anywhere else in person or in drills.
Yeah. And look, his film at A&M wasn't great. I mean, he was a guy who had, he had 2.5 sacks his last year at A&M. He just wasn't a standout guy. And I'm sure every team, after they saw those workout numbers, just sort of said, kind of matches what we saw on film here. And that's how you go undrafted. And, you know, he certainly has put it together since.
Well, keep in mind, too, that you get coached once you go to the NFL.
Yes.
We forget that.
Yep.
And we say, oh, a guy's a bust or something. Well, how do we know the coach wasn't doing a poor job or just didn't communicate well, or the guy and the coach didn't click? Maybe Bennett didn't work with his position coach at A&M. We're theorizing now. But maybe he's gotten better teaching for his style of learning since being in the pros. And sometimes maybe it's that simple.
But a lot of times, I mean, look, you're going to take the guy with the raw athleticism, with the raw ability, and Bennett just didn't profile as that guy either coming out of college. He obviously does now, but you know, it's been fascinating to just watch him develop into the player he's become, because he is outright dominant at this point. So Michael Bennett coming in at 7, at 6, one of the tougher guys to place on this list, Ndamukong Suh. He was 7th for you, 4 for me, and 4 for Irwin. You know, I'm going to throw this question at you because there were some accusations being thrown around early last year, which I think you touched on a little bit in one of your columns. But the word leaking out of Miami was that Sue was freelancing too much early last year when the Dolphins were just sort of a train wreck coming out of the gates. Did you see that at all when you watched him on tape last year, or was that just, I don't know, someone just throwing out garbage for the most part?
Personally, I thought it was more the latter. I'm not saying it was, but I didn't see evidence of the freelancing on film. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. I don't know the defensive calls. There's a lot of small nuances to stuff, and some of it you're not ever going to tell on film. You have to be the one in the room coaching these guys because you know exactly what you asked them to do. So I don't know. I thought his season overall in Miami was a little underwhelming based on what we've come to expect from him. Not enough to take him off of the list by any means.
Yeah.
And what we have to remember with Sue, he's a different animal than these other guys. These other guys, a lot of them were talking about explosive quickness off the snap. That's not Sue's game. He's good off the snap, but he's not going to beat you like that 30 times in a game. Where he gets you is he has really good build-up strength. He wears you down over the course of a play, and especially over the course of a game, and just out-strongmans you over time.
Yeah, I mean, his game is so effort-based, and I'm not saying he didn't put in the effort last year, but I could see after the way they started that year how he might have not had the full motivation that he would normally play with.
That's an interesting point, too. His game is very effort-based. Yeah, that's I agree with that.
I mean, I gave him the benefit of the doubt, obviously. I still had him in the top five here. I don't know. What do you think he does in Vance Joseph's system this year?
Well, he'll play the Geno Atkins role.
Yep.
So that will be a little more one-gapping stuff. He'll be a three technique. I think Sue is interesting. When he was with Detroit, he was the three technique as well. He lined up between the guard and the tackle, and his job was to shoot that gap, like a lot of these guys on this list. But where he was most interesting to me was when they moved him around, they played him at defensive end at times. I wonder if Joseph will do that. That's not how Cincinnati's done things with their defensive line. They've been pretty consistent with their fronts and who plays where. And if that's the case, Sue's going to be Geno Atkins in that scheme. Earl Mitchell will be the nose shade. Earl Mitchell's a good player, too, by the way.
Yep.
So I don't know. I'll be real interested to see the first 4 weeks of the season, how they use him, whether he's versatile or if they're going to make him static.
Well, that's Sue coming in at six on our countdown. We are going to take a quick 30-second break here and be back with the top five defensive linemen in football. When Brent Musburger signed his new deal on ESPN and the SEC Network, Richard Deitch invited him onto the SI Media podcast for a conversation about his long career and the state of sports media in 2016. That's the SI Media podcast this week with Richard Deitch and Brent Musburger. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher, and si.com/podcasts. All right, before we dive into the top five defensive linemen in football, we're going to take another mailbag question here. This is Daniel from La Jolla, who I believe checked in last week, too. But he drops a line here. In ranking these position groups, do any of them stand out to you as particularly strong or weak relative to the historical average? Seems to me the defensive line groups are pretty strong, and running back might be a little weak, though it's hard to separate from schematic changes. But you guys are the experts. What do you think? You referring to us at this point?
I agree with Daniel. I think he's right on. This defensive line is a strong group. I would be surprised if there have been groups quite this strong in other years, especially considering that it gets stronger as you go. The guys at the top of this group are unbelievable players.
Yeah.
And running back has been the weakest group we've done, and it's probably the weakest it's been in several years. Statistically, last year, there weren't a lot of big-time 1,000-yard rushers. I think only two guys had over 1,100, if I'm not mistaken. I would agree with Daniel. I don't know how he ranks exactly. You'd have to go through every single year and do that, and that can't be done now. What do you think, though, Gary?
I would agree. I would throw out tight ends as a group that's a little weak, and I say this because of this. I think across the league, coaches want to feature tight ends more and more, and I think there are just not enough good ones. And I think that's why you see some guys, you saw some contracts going out to, I guess I won't name names, but, you know, some guys getting paid and you're kind of like,
It's interesting because the tight end's more important than ever as a position right now. And the question is, does the talent match that? Do they have the talent to fill that level of importance? Teams that have really good tight ends have huge advantages in their passing games, though.
We can
agree on that because they can create mismatches based on where they align the tight end. And those mismatches can be for the wide receivers, not just the tight end.
Yep. Now, it's a discussion because it's been a couple years since we saw a tight end go in the first round of the draft. And I think there's a real shortage between what college football is providing the NFL and what the NFL wants right now. And I think that's why you're seeing some guys who are maybe a little bit middling talent-wise getting paid because there's a desperation for tight ends. I think that's a group that's, I don't know. I think they're being overrated just a bit when you go deep. And not to mention, you know, for a lot of teams, blocking's not a huge role for the tight end anymore.
Not in college especially. So
yeah.
Colleges are using the tight ends differently. The NFL teams are seeing that, so they're less secure about taking a tight end, which is why they don't go for him in the first round. And furthermore, I'd take it one more step and say, teams feel that tight end's a position you have to coach them when they come into the league. You're not going to get a finished and ready product as a rookie. And I think now teams are more liberal with who they pick based on that. They say, okay, if we have to coach them anyway, why don't we take that super athletic basketball player and just coach him instead of coach the less athletic tight end who kind of played a little bit in the Big 12. And look at some of the guys on our list from last week, a few weeks ago, Julius Thomas, mid-round pick, athletic type, Jimmy Graham, mid-round pick, athletic type, Antonio Gates, undrafted, super athletic type. So I think tight ends, more than ever, it's probably viewed as a developmental position right now. And what's funny is that developmental position is more important than ever for a lot of teams.
Yeah, it's a weird spot there. I was talking to Andy Staples last offseason leading up to the draft. Andy Staples, the great Campus Rush writer. And he said a lot of recruiters are basically going to basketball games to find their tight ends now, which I guess says all you need to know about the state of that position down throughout levels of football.
Yeah, because other coaches at other levels, younger levels, high school, junior high is probably extreme, but high school, college, they're not coaching them the way the guys at the higher levels want, and so they don't need to be taking the same guys.
Yep. Well, there you go, Daniel. Good question. And with that, we are going to jump right back into our countdown. Top defensive lineman in football, coming in fifth, man who just got paid, Fletcher Cox. He was fourth for you, fifth for me, seventh for Irwin, comes in fifth on our countdown. Just got a six-year extension, $63 million guaranteed, which is more than Sue got a year ago. I mean, look, he's a guy the Eagles obviously wanted to keep. They have been very active all offseason, and Cox is a guy who gets paid as Howie Roseman steps back into the pilot seat there in Philly. You talked about Cox a little bit last episode, two episodes ago.
Yeah, because I mentioned I'd watched film with a few different coaches and players the last month or so, and all of them said the guy that they are scared of most along the defensive line is Fletcher Cox. Yeah. And they all said it on their own. Like, I wasn't asking them. They said, hey, by the way, this is the guy that gives us problems. People hate playing against Fletcher Cox. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to a one-gap scheme as well there under Jim Schwartz. And Cox, I think, will be very good in that, getting upfield. He doesn't have a lot of weaknesses to his game. He's kind of a combination of Gerald McCoy and Ndamukong Suh style-wise. He's got that kind of strength that Suh has, and he can wear you down and win late in the play, just like he can win early in the play. And he wins early in the play because he's got a little bit of the quick get-off that McCoy has. He's not as quick as McCoy. He's not as strong as Suh, but he's close in both categories. And you put that together and you get a $63 million guaranteed defensive tackle.
I don't know if the Eagles are going to score a lot of points this year as they sort of enter a transitional year with the quarterbacks and not very good receivers and all that. But that defensive line is going to be really good. Cox, Curry, Barwin, Brandon Graham rotating in. I mean, Jim Schwartz has a lot to work with there.
He does. The one thing that gives me pause, I don't know if they've got the other edge guy they need. I know Connor Barwin had 12 sacks a few years ago. He had 5 last year. And I think he's a tremendous player. But I think he's a tremendous player in a 3-4 where he has a versatile range of responsibilities. Coverage, reading the QB, spying at times, setting up teammates for stunts, twists, all that kind of stuff, which he'll still do a little bit here in Philadelphia. But he's not a burning, bend-the-edge type of pass rusher. So that's the only – I think Brandon Graham is that. I think Benny Curry could be that. He's better inside. I agree with you overall. That's just the one thing that gives me pause. I think that I bet you they'll take a defensive end in the draft next year pretty high.
Yeah. I was also wondering, and this is a long shot, but Marcus Smith, the guy they drafted in the first round 2 years ago, is as a very, very raw developmental edge bender, and he never worked out under the Chip Kelly regime. You know, I wonder if they can unlock something in him. I'm not saying the guy is going to all of a sudden live up to his first round billing, but if he is ever going to come around, this seems to be the time and the scheme he's going to do it in.
Yeah, it'd be nice if they gave him one position to learn. It's a disservice to him the last couple of years. But keep in mind, if he were playing any one position particularly well, he probably would have stuck at that one position.
So exactly.
Guys get moved around. You say, oh, how dare the coaches? Well, they also move the guy around because the player wasn't enticing at any one position. He wasn't good enough. So, yeah, Marcus Smith, it's a big, big year for Marcus Smith. heading into year three here, their first round pick of 2014.
Yeah. And again, I'm not predicting a Marcus Smith breakout here, but I'm just saying he's a guy I'll pay attention to this preseason and see if they can get anything out of that investment. So Fletcher Cox coming in fifth. In fourth, Muhammad Wilkerson, a guy who everyone's just been waiting for him to get paid. And it looks like it is not going to happen in New York. Rich Cimini over at ESPN.com said the door is closed on extension talks. I guess not terribly surprising considering the depth they have on the defensive line. But Wilkerson, elite player, you had him two. I had him seven, Irwin had him six, but you had him second. What makes him so good? And if you're the Jets and you need to allocate money to different places, obviously, and you have Leonard Williams and you have Sheldon Richardson, would you let Wilkerson walk?
If I were still coached by Rex Ryan, I would not, because of what we talked about, yep. How they asked their D lineman to kick the tail of the guy in front of him, and the rest of the scheme gets figured out from there. But they're coached by Todd Bowles, and he's a little bit different with his approach, and they win a little bit more through alignment and where they put guys. They'll stuff the line, they'll condense their fronts, and cram the box against the run, and then against the pass, they don't look for edge rushers so much. They look for blitzers up the middle, because Todd Bowles mm-hmm. believes in crowding the A-gaps and obstructing the quarterback's vision and getting guys in his face. So with that in mind, is Wilkerson great? I think he's great. I have him number two. But do you need that kind of entity at the price he costs in order to run the scheme that Todd Bowles wants to run? And the answer is probably not. It's a little bit of a luxury. I think that's how they're viewing it. Now, yeah. I happen to think there are certain guys you want to be very careful about that with, guys that transcend the scheme because they're so good. I think Wilkerson borders on it. And if they were to lose him after this season, they'll have questions in their pass rush, even though they can manufacture with a blitz. Mm-hmm. Leonard Williams last year did not play in the sub packages down the stretch. They took him on, and they did early in the year, which means they thought he'd be a good pass rusher, and he really wasn't for mm-hmm. them. So they've got Sheldon Richardson and Leonard Williams, but Richardson can mimic Wilkerson. I don't know if Williams can, though.
Yeah. Well, we're going to see. He's probably going to get a shot in another city a year from now. Muhammad Wilkerson coming in fourth. Coming in third, Geno Atkins. Top five for all three of us. You had him fifth. Irwin and I had him third. I think it's kind of easy to forget that Atkins was coming off the torn ACL last year, and I don't know if this much was expected of him. He was pretty much back to vintage Geno Atkins for the most part, especially in the second half of last year. And, you know, vintage Geno Atkins is as good as anyone not named J.J. Watt in this league.
Yeah, he had the ACL in 2013. And so he came back in 14. And I think he was a little up and down, but last season, no question about it, he was fully Geno Atkins again. And that was good to see because he was so intriguing as a player in 2013. I remember he hurt his knee on Halloween night. Yep. Spoiled my Halloween that year. It's against the Dolphins. And I felt so bad because he had been so fun to watch on film. A low to the ground player, sudden brute strength off the snap, good initial quickness. But where he gets you is when he delivers a bull rush to you, he's going to be under your pads with power. And there's not a guard in the league that can handle that.
Yeah. And similarly, we'll just jump ahead to number two real quick, is Aaron Donald. Similar build. And, you know, Geno Atkins was fourth round pick back in 2010. And the knock on him was, you know, how can a 6 foot, 300 pound guy do it on the interior of the line? And by the time Aaron Donald came around 4 years later, it was all the Geno Atkins comparisons. And this guy's the next Geno Atkins. And he is right in that class. And you spent some time with Aaron Donald last year for a film study. And I would like to hear all about him, Andy.
Yeah, he was great. He is stocky. He was short.
Yeah.
By NFL standards, I was a little taken aback by that because he doesn't. When he walks into a room, he's big, but you wouldn't know that he's a dominant defensive lineman.
Yeah.
I like him. I think he understands the game. He was good in our film session. We got along great. He understood the game well. I think he needs to become a little bit more disciplined in certain areas, though. He will go back, as he calls it, backdooring a blocker, which means if it's a zone block and he has to get over the top of the blocker to get outside, sometimes he'll just go underneath the blocker and trust his speed that can trace down the ball carrier. And that is a very sharp, double-edged sword. And when he sometimes goes under blocks, it's in inappropriate situations, certain obvious running situations. If you're going to go under the block, you don't want it to be an obvious running situation, because that's how you get creased up the middle of a run game. So I think we're splitting hairs on the negative with Donald, because we can just sit here and say, oh, he's good too, just like all these other D tackles. If he's to become fully what he's capable of, which is probably the best three technique in the NFL, I think he needs to get a little bit more consistent in some of the nuanced part of run defense.
All right. And voting wise, you had him 3. Jeff and I each had Aaron Donald 2. And, you know, LA again, Aaron Donald and Todd Gurley, that's not a bad team to be bringing into your city. Not to mention Jared Goff, number one overall pick in the draft. We're going to mix in one more mailbag question here as it pertains to the Rams. This is from Joe Rosnowski via Talkback. The general perception of Jeff Fisher is that he is an average to below average head coach, and his record backs this up. What are your thoughts on him, and do you think he is the right guy for the Rams moving forward? I have a lukewarm take on this. I don't know if you want to take a crack at it first, Andy.
Well, I kind of disagree a little bit on the assertion that that the perception of Fisher is a below average or slightly below average head coach. I've always thought that people view Fisher as a great head coach because he's always a sure thing with his job. He had long job security in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. He had good job security in St. Louis and now Los Angeles. He's never had trouble finding work, really high level work. As a head coach, he's always had a job. And his record is not of a guy that would always have a job as a head coach.
Yeah, and I don't know, average to below average, I don't know where you put him. If I'm ranking the head coaches, I guess he's somewhere in the 10 to 20 range is a complete guess. My point with Fisher has always been he always has a good defense. His guys seem to always play hard for him, and I think there's something to be said for a voice getting old, a voice getting sort of lost with the players after a little while. It just doesn't have the same effect. And I think that's when you start to think about moving on. I don't think they're at that point in LA. And now that they have a quarterback, I mean, look, he never really had the guy in Tennessee. They had the revolving door there all the time. And if Jared Goff's, obviously they've invested the number one overall pick in him. So if you can't make it work with Goff in 2 or 3 years, then, you know, it's time to move on. But, you know, is he Bill Belichick? Probably not. But if you gave Jeff Fisher Tom Brady for 15 years, would he have won some Super Bowls?
Yeah,
probably.
I gotcha. Yeah. You know, when he had Steve McNair, he won 11 or more games 4 out of 5 years in the McNair era. But since then, since 2004 on, he's 2-9 for winning records, meaning he's had 2 winning records and 9 .500 or worse records out of those last 11 seasons. So I understand I've always wondered about Jeff Fisher, too, because I'm a little surprised he doesn't get more criticism just because of the record. I don't know what kind of coach he is. I'm not in the room with him. I see his scheme. His scheme's worked well, but he also delegates pretty well too to his assistants. But I'm a little surprised that he's regarded as highly as I think he's regarded around the league.
Yeah. I mean, look, I guess my roundabout point on him was I don't think he's problematic. I don't think he's a bad coach for whatever that's worth. I think if you gave him the right quarterback and the right team, and I think he has the right team, we'll see if Goff is the right quarterback, but you know, I think he can have you in Super Bowl contention, and that's really all you can ask for. Well, that brings us to the very anticlimactic conclusion of this countdown of the top defensive linemen. J.J. Watt, unanimous number one. You had mentioned last week, Andy, I mean, on pace to be the best defensive player of all time at this point.
Yeah, he's absolutely the best that I've ever seen. I'm younger and I haven't been studying film as long as other guys. My guess is around the league, I bet you everyone would agree, though. If he does what he's done the last 3 or 4 years, if he can do that another 3 or 4 and then be solid for 2 or 3 after that and have a nice 12-year career of dominance like he would, he'll be considered the best of all time.
Yeah. I remember there's a game 2 years ago where they played New England, not the playoff game, the one before that. And I think he was held without a sack. He had statistically not a great game, but he was wrecking everything the Patriots did offensively. And you just don't see that happen to the Patriots very often. J.J. Watt does it to him sometimes, and Von Miller does it to him sometimes, and that's about it.
His film's more impressive than his numbers, and his numbers are more impressive than anybody else's numbers.
Yeah.
Do you take him over any other guy if you're building a team right now defensively?
Yeah. Yeah, you got to. Even if you think you're only going to get, what, 4 more years of his prime or whatever the math would be. I mean, he's too good. And I don't think the Texans have a whole lot of talent around him. I mean, it's pretty upsetting to think what that team would be if you took J.J. Watt off of it. That's going to do it for this week. We're going to be back next week. Probably something on the offensive line, I would imagine, because we are going to save quarterbacks for the finale. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, that works for me. We have stacked linebackers we have to do as well at some point.
Yeah. Well, we've been alternating defense-offense, so probably probably stick with that. If you miss any of the past shows, we have ranked a whole bunch of positions already. You can go listen to them. iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, anything else we might happen to be on. You can find all those old shows. You can follow Andy and I on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. We're also on Facebook. Thanks, as always, to Jeff Irwin, our researcher, and Alex Abnos, our producer and editor, who will pull this whole thing together. And most of all, thank you so much to all of you who listen, who enjoy the show. If you haven't already, please go to iTunes, leave a review. That will do it. We will see you next week. I am Gary Grambling. He was Andy Benoit, and this was the MMQB Podcast.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.